Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to this special Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes, a chance to honor all who have served and share a story that goes a lot deeper than the hour we have on the radio today. For photos and videos related to what you're hearing today, make sure you visit the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And if you missed the beginning of the program, you can find this podcast and all of our episodes online at hometownheroesradio.com. I bring that up because we heard from Les Beck about the improbable way he met a man who slept in the same barracks in the same prisoner of war camp as Les's late father. That was at Stalag 17B in Krems, Austria, and Orville Lewis of Orange Cove, California, is Les's new best friend. We've been diving into Orville's story. He told us about some of his early experiences with the 388th Bomb Group, the 563rd Squadron, flying out of Nettleshall, England. And this is in July 1943, early on in the air war in Europe, a time when the German Luftwaffe had plenty of fighter planes to send at you.
Well, in our interrogation before we'd make a flight, usually they'd say it'd be about 600 ME-109s here and heavy flak neck plates. Then we'd be 500 maybe with FW-190s. There were several hundred airplanes we were going to meet on each mission we went. And the flak was terrible. That was worse than the planes. I didn't mind the planes. You could shoot back. But the flak, you could not do anything about it. It just black out. But I was very fortunate. I only had one hole knocked within the side of my shoulder in my turret. And that's close as flak ever came to hitting me. But that's close enough. It knocked a hole in that plane.
Well, now it's starting to make sense. You know, I'm thinking here that you beat ridiculous odds just to meet the son of someone who was in your prison camp, but hearing how many airplanes were fighting against you and how much ground fire there was, you beat some pretty good odds to survive those missions. But I'm sure in the midst of it, you were aware of other planes and other crews who didn't survive?
Oh, definitely so. I saw some of them didn't look so good. They really just exploded in the air. I guess the oxygen or something blew up and just pieces of it flying in the air. And then you could see plane going down and fighters circling it, be 6 or 8 fighters around it. Kind of wore on your nerves a little bit, but at least you could see those fighters coming in and you could shoot at them, but you couldn't shoot at the flak.
Well, you can say it get on your nerves a little bit. I'm trying to understand how it doesn't scare you to death.
I guess it did, but you know, what got me worse than anything, I had twin 50s, and one of them I'd fire one round, and it lock up. I only had one working, but the German fighter didn't know that. Had one guy come straight down at me, and I turned the turret up at him, and he veered off. He thought I had twins, I guess. Just wasn't good. And the day we got shot down, I had both of them working perfect because I found the trouble myself. There was a screw in the belt pawl feed that would come down the first round, and it locked up, and it would not fire. Now, I had that working perfect, but I didn't get to use it at all that day.
Well, I want to hear all about that mission, but I guess it would be interesting, too, to discuss your fourth mission, because this is the same mission on which Les's father was shot down. July 26, 43, Hanover was the target. And that sounds like that was a pretty eventful mission for all the B-17s in the air.
It was. I know we lost a lot of planes that day. I don't remember the exact number, but we lost real heavy that day. We was attacked from the time we hit across the English Channel until we got back. Even our plane happened to be get attacked as we got back to the channel that day. Well, there's Mrs. Smith 210s, the fighter bombers. There's 3 or 4 of them. I think there were 4. Just getting to the White Cliffs of Dover there, here they came. Right, we was by ourselves. But we put one of them down in smoke. I don't know whether he went on down or not, but I had my flight suit halfway down around my feet, and I couldn't get around in time. I told the pilot and co-pilot I got caught with my pants down that time.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. But we drove them off anyway.
Well, you say that like that's not a big deal, but I want people to understand. First of all, you've survived fighters all the way to the target, all the way from your base in England, all the way into Germany, Hanover, fighters all the way, flak over the target. You're on the way home. You're almost home. And how many German planes are coming for just your plane?
I'm pretty sure there's just four of them.
Only four. Oh, that's four against one. That's not a bad odds or anything. So, and you are on the top turret?
Correct. And I asked the pilot to lower his left wing, which he did. And it looked like my tracer was going into that plane, but he kept flying. But he left us alone after that.
How do you keep your wits about you in that situation? Because you're outnumbered. They've got more firepower than you do. Their planes are faster than yours. How do you keep functioning and do what you have to do?
I don't know. You just automatically train to do it, I guess, because you know you have to do it. One plane that day, an FW-190, that was Goering Circus, we call him. He came down. I was after a plane in front of me, and I looked up at an angle. Here come one. I ducked my head. His prop was that close. My turret was too slow to get on him. The time I got on him, he was flying through the formation. I couldn't shoot at him because it would hit my own plane. But I actually, his prop was within inches of my head. But my turret was too slow to get around on him. You just automatically, you fight. You just do what you have to do. I'll tell you this much. Every flight I made, I'll never make another flight. But you know, the next morning we'd be out there running around, ready to go again next morning.
So you get home from them, oh, I don't ever want to do that again, but you're right back at it. And I'm glad you said that, because as I look at the dates of all the missions that you flew, you guys really were flying almost every day. How exhausting was that?
It was very exhausting. And I tell you, if it lasted, I don't know of anyone that made those 25 missions back in those days. They told me if you make three of them, you're very fortunate. And I'll tell you, it was rough.
Well, let's talk about your seventh and final mission. Kassel, Germany is the target, July 30th, 1943. And I imagine July 30th is a day you've never forgotten. It certainly changed your life, didn't it?
It was the day I was inducted into the service and the day I was shot down, 1 year to the day.
Makes it a pretty special day every year for you, I guess. So take us start to finish from that day. It must have been a pretty long day for you, but remember for us what you can.
As we got out over the English Channel, I test-fired my gun. They were perfect. And we hadn't much more than got. We were over Belgium, which is not very far inland, whenever the sky just blacked out in front of us. It was flak. We were flying 21,000. And as far as I know, we were tailing Charlie. We'd had the trouble getting the plane right. Something went wrong, and we were tailing Charlie, and the planes kept aborting. First time we'd ever got 500 bombers in the air, but they were aborting so fast that we just kept pulling up, and we got up into the formation. Just as we settled down, we were hit. We got a direct hit through number three gas tank, and that fuel poured all over the plane, and the metal was spewing all over us, and there were fighters coming in. Well, I put my chute on and crawling back up my turret to get a shot at them. Co-pilot pulled me down, said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Get out of here." Well, metal was spewing all over us, and the radio man and I were supposed to go out to Bombay. Well, I saw the Bombay doors, and then I give a hard tug and the bomb dropped. And the flames were coming up and just lapping up, and I timed it in between those flames and jumped out. Radio man, I talked to him later, said he opened the door. He just slammed it back, said all he could see was fire in there. So he went back, jumped out the rear, the left-hand side of the fuselage. At that time, they had where the door gunners were. He went out that side. So I timed myself, looked at my little chute. It's an English, well, it's an emergency chute, 22-foot, and you hit the ground hard with them. Well, I checked to see that it wasn't on fire, and I laid there, and the wind whistled around the airplane going on away. Finally, I decided I'll pull a ripcord because I couldn't up there at 21,000 because of no oxygen. I was breathing real hard, and so finally I couldn't find it. And I knew it had to be there. I thought, well, that isn't there. I got to rip this thing apart. Well, I found it finally, and I jerked it, and I was laying flat on my back, and in my head and heels felt like it touched, and it hurt me pretty bad because the chute didn't fit me. The first time I was in the service, I had the chute adjusted, and they gave me the wrong harness back. And I never put it on when I left, and I should have. But anyway, I was going down, fighter planes come in, and I thought, well, I was on target for them. But the German came through, and he gave me a prop wash. And it folded my chute up. I tried to straighten it out, and I made it worse. So I made up my mind that from now on I'll just leave it alone. And then the other plane went by, and waved at me, those German pilots. I waved back at him. Shoot me, go ahead.
You mean he waved with his hands or he tipped his wings? He waved with his hands at you. He was that close.
He acted that close, he waved with his hand. And then one of the guys, I could see him floating down the chute out there, and I yelled at him and waved at him. He never did answer me or wave back. Anyway, I hit the ground in what was the name of that little town in Belgium? I forget. Oh, Antwerp. It wasn't too little. Yeah. I landed in the gutter of a street there. The guy with a double barrel shotgun, a Belgian, he pointed that gun at him to help. He captured me, you know, but he helped me roll my chute up, and here come the Germans on motorbikes. Two of them. I couldn't run. I couldn't do anything. My back was hurting me. And so they come up and stuck a little gun in my stomach, and hands up. So I put my hands up. They searched me, and the Gestapo came along in the car. I had a chauffeur, and he riding in the back, threw me in the car with him. And he gave me a hard time. I said, well, we didn't start the war. You guys started. And I shouldn't have said that. He blew his lid, boy, and I thought, sure, he's going to shoot me. Said, my home was in Cologne. Said, his family was all killed. His bombers did it. Because at Cologne was where they had a ball bearing factory, and we'd hit it pretty hard, and his family was killed. They took us out to headquarters and took me in and interrogated me, wanted to know how many actually bombers we had and how high we flew, and we were making flights. And they tried to get me to okay that, and I told them that the Geneva Convention said, we give you our name, rank, and serial number, and that's all you're getting. Well, they said, we can tell you then. And so they told me where I went to school, where I went to in the service, who my officers were. They had a history better than I knew it. And they knew, they had the best knowledge of people they knew. They just wanted me to agree with them. I wouldn't do it.
Did that blow your mind a little bit, though, realizing how much they knew about you?
I didn't think, I knew they knew a lot, but not like they did. They knew everything, who I went to school with even, and my teacher's names. I don't know how they got it, but they had it. I wouldn't say I was scared, but I very cautious. I'll put it like that, what went on. Because there were times when I could have been killed in that prison camp and in between, too. There were things that happened. Put me in a very dangerous spot, I'll put it like that.
Well, there's so many different directions. I'm tempted to go with you here because it's such a fascinating existence that most of us can't even identify with. I do want to ask one thing, though. In light of your past history, you told us long before you're ever in the service, you broke out of jail. So now that you're in this big prison camp, is there a party that says, hey, maybe I can escape?
Well, I played with the Barbed Wire Mountaineers. We organized, the Red Cross got us instruments in there. And I'll tell you, when the guys were digging the tunnel, everybody get out. We'd go over to the barracks and we'd stomp our foot on so they wouldn't detect that, because they had sound, we're picking up sounds all the time for tunnels. And we'd play and stomp and while he's digging under there. Well, they finally got the tunnel done. And the first two guys started out, and they got to the end of it. There's two guards sitting there with guns. They're starting to run back the other way, and there's two guys the other end. That's the end of that tunnel. They made guys come in and fill that tunnel full. What they did, they'd take that, they tied their pants at the bottom, they put that dirt in the and they walked in the compound out there and drained that dirt out.
Like people probably seen that in The Great Escape. That was something that was depicted there. But did those two guys, were they executed or just punished?
No, they put them in the boob. Yeah. They had a boob there that they put you in, like Steve McQueen in that.
Yeah.
They had one of those. And
bouncing the ball against the wall, Steve McQueen in that movie. So this is solitary confinement.
Yes, it was. And they made it through. But we had a guy from our barracks was always giving them a rough time, and he was in that boob so much, he liked to die in there. But he put on a Russian, he got some Russian clothes, and he got him a stick with a nail in, which the Russians would work, and they'd come in, pick up the papers and things and trash in between the barbed wire. He was doing that. He crawled over the barbed wire and in between and crawled over the outside. He got about 100 yards and camped. The German guard that was over our barracks saw him, recognized him, and he went and got him. Poor guy, he stayed in there so long then, but he come out, he was really in bad shape, but he had got the plans somewhere from Mr. Smith 210. He and I were intending to take, if we ever got out of there, take those plans and steal Mr. Smith's plane and fly it back to England. We never did get out to go do it. So probably a good thing we didn't. We got shot stealing a plane.
Or the Brits would have shot you down because they didn't know you were you.
And we'd have been on the radio talking.
Well, you finally did get out of Stalag 17B, taken with other prisoners on an 18-day forced march until you tasted freedom again.
So 18 days marching what was the weather like? What was the food like? What were the conditions like? And was that scarier than staying in the camp?
Actually, I was happy to get out of that camp, and it was kind of scary, but now the weather was first night out, it came a sleet storm. We slept right out on the ground, and it rained a couple of times, but otherwise, I didn't mind the weather that bad at all. But one place, I forget the name of the town, it bombed out. The English are hitting at night and the American day. And that night, we slept in a bombed out where a bomb had hit all over, and they lit that place up. The English did at night, dropping bombs all around. And we crossed the bridge. It was loaded with explosives underneath. You could see them. The Austrians were slaughtering our beef because they didn't want the Russians getting it. And they gave us fresh meat. We got dysentery really bad. And walking through town, the guys, it's too bad. They had to go right in the streets. That's the worst part about that. But I took off and went to home there. I had a piece of Ivor soap. And there's a bunch of women there, and I guess sewing circle or something. But I told them I wanted to trade that soap for something to eat. Prima Americana, Seifisch, Urein Brot. Well, they come out with a loaf of bread, and I give them about a quarter of a piece of Ivor soap. I run and got back in formation. And then we got to a rest. They said, we're going to be here a couple of hours. Well, I took off. I went down a ravine. I walked down about a mile and I found a flour mill. I had a pair of GI pants. I traded that to him for about 5 pounds of flour, and I sneaked back into camp. If it was, there's a bunch of little young German boys, if they'd found me, they'd kill you. They didn't ask any questions. They were mean little guys. But I got in and out and in, rather. Took 10, rolled it out, and made hardtack, just water with that. And I shared it with my buddies. That was rough walking because they made us walk pretty fast. But sometimes the farmers would have milk cans out on the route, I guess, and they'd disappear as we'd walk by, guys sticking them up. And one place we went by the hen house, and the chickens were flying around in there, and the GIs run in there, and they come out with one under each arm. Here come the guard right behind them with a goose net. But we picked up food like that, but my 25th birthday, we got a Red Cross parcel. They went to a camp somewhere on the east side of Austria, and they'd been liberated. So they brought them back through, and they gave them to us. I got 15 pounds of concentrated food. Man, I'm telling you, that was a relief. That's where we got our food then.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, it was the best birthday I ever had.
Tell me about how you finally realized, how it happened that you were finally a free man again, after almost 2 years of not knowing freedom, not tasting freedom.
Oh, it felt really good, but I'll tell you a little story on that. That was there at Lahar, they were building an airstrip. The first plane that landed there was a B-17. Well, I was in a tent with about 12 or 13 other guys. I went over there and I asked a pilot about a ride across the channel with him. He said, well, I'm not authorized to haul anyone, but said, I'm leaving, and he looked at his watch in about 10 minutes. I'm not looking back in the fuselage. Somebody happened to be back there. I'm not looking back there. So I run back to the tent and I grabbed all the guys in there. We ran back and jumped in that fuselage. Just as we slammed the door, he took off down the runway. And we landed not at the same base that I was based at, Thetford. The guys lined up for payday. And I walked in there. They treated me like a king. I'm telling you, I enjoyed that. Then I realized I was free.
And he has been ever since, with a great appreciation for what it means to be free, and this year, a newfound friend who has stirred up rich memories of those days long ago. There's more to Orville's story, and you can hear more of his interview at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find plenty of photos. Do me a favor, make sure you thank all the veterans in your life for their service to our country, and maybe ask them a question or two about what they did. You never know what you're going to find. We're out of time for now. I'm Paul Leffler, encouraging you to remember on Veterans Day and every day that freedom is not free.